The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm going to read to you the Bret Stephens column again. I read it in hour one. This is hour three of today's program. And I talked about it in the first segment of this hour with Bret Baier of Fox News, special report fame. And I'm going to talk to you about it after. 1-800-520-1234 is my phone number. Jacob will take your calls. 1-800-520-1234. I specifically want to know what you think of Bret Stephens' column, not what you think about anything else. What do you think of this column? Bret is a friend of the show. He's a frequent guest. He's a fine writer. "I was wrong about Trump voters" is the headline. "The worst line I ever wrote as a pundit," yes, I know it's a crowded field, "was the first line I ever wrote about the man who would become the 45th president, colon, quote, if by now you didn't find Donald Trump appalling, you are appalling, close quote. This opening salvo from August 2015 was the first in what would become dozens of columns denouncing Trump as a unique threat to American life, democratic ideals, and the world itself. I regret almost nothing of what I said about the man and his close minions, but the broad swipe at his voters caricatured them and blinkered me. It also probably did more to help than hinder Trump's candidacy. Telling voters they are moral ignoramuses is a bad way of getting them to change their mind. What were they saying that I wasn't?" Bret asks. "That ought to have been the first question to ask myself. When I looked at Trump," Stephen says, "I saw a bigoted blowhard making one ignorant argument after another. What Trump's supporters saw was a candidate whose entire being was a proudly raised middle finger at a self-satisfied elite that had produced a failing status quo. I was blind to this," Stephens confesses. "Though I had spent the years of Barack Obama's presidency denouncing his policies, my objections were more abstract than personal. I belonged to a social class that my friend Peggy Noonan called the protected. My family lived in a safe and pleasant neighborhood. Our kids went to an excellent public school. I was well-paid, fully insured, insulated against life's harsh edges. Trump's appeal, according to Noonan, was largely to people she called, quote, the unprotected. Their neighborhoods weren't so safe and pleasant. Their schools weren't so excellent. Their livelihoods weren't so secure. Their experience of America was often one of cultural economic decline, something felt in the most personal of ways. It was an experience compounded by the insult of being treated as losers and racists, clinging, in Obama's notorious 2008 phrase, to guns or religion or antipathy toward people who aren't like them. No wonder they were angry. Anger can take dumb or dangerous turns, and with Trump, they often took both. But that didn't mean the anger was unfounded or illegitimate, or that it was aimed at the wrong target. Trump voters had a powerful case to make that they had been thrice betrayed by the nation's elite. First after a 9-11, when they had borne much of the brunt of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, only to see Washington fumble and then abandon the efforts. Second after the financial crisis of 2008, when so many were being laid off, even as the financial class was being bailed out. Third in the post-crisis recovery, in which years of ultra-low interest rates were a bonanza for those with investable assets and brutal for those without. Oh, and then came the great American cultural revolution of the 2010s, in which traditional practices and beliefs regarding same-sex marriage, sex-segregated bathrooms, personal pronouns, meritocratic ideals, race-blind rules, reverence for patriotic symbols, the rules of romance, the presumption of innocence, and the distinction between equality of opportunity and outcome became more and more not just passé, but taboo. It's one thing for social mores to evolve over time, aided by respect for differences of opinion. It's another for them to be abruptly imposed by one side on another, with little democratic input but a great deal of moral bullying. This was the climate in which Trump's campaign flourished, I could have thought a little harder about the fact that in my dripping condescension towards his supporters, I was also confirming their suspicions about people like me, people who talked a good game about the virtues of empathy but practice it only selectively, people unscathed by the country's problems yet unembarrassed to propound solutions. I could also have given Trump voters more credit for nuance. For every in-your-face MAGA warrior, there were plenty of ambivalent Trump supporters, doubtful of his ability and dismayed by his manner, who were willing to take their chances on him because he had the nerve to defy deeply flawed conventional pieties. I'll finish it after the break, and I'll take your calls at 1-800-520-1234 right here on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. On this Thursday, I'm live from Studio North up in Maine. I'm so glad you can join me. I am joined by Brett Baer, host of Special Report, the anchor on Fox News every night at 6 p.m. Good morning, Brett. How are you?
Morning, Hugh.
I want to begin with a little bit of a roundabout to my subject. You're a product of Catholic schools, and you're a very good golfer. I'm curious, did you play much on public courses?
I played a little bit on public courses, yeah. I mean, I played on teams where we practiced on public courses, and but a lot of time on private courses.
All right. Now, you went to DePaul University, you went to the Pentagon, 11 trips to Afghanistan, 13 to Iraq. I point this out because if you go to Catholic schools and you play golf on public courses at all, you run into the great American middle class. That is just inevitable. There is a column today in the New York Times by Brett Stevens on what he was wrong, most wrong about, Trump voters. And I believe it's because Manhattan Beltway media elites don't have any connection with America's middle class. And I mean, everybody on every public course everywhere, 9 out of 10 are going to come from America's great middle class. Do you agree with my proposition?
I agree.
And Catholic schools, you're going to run into all kinds of people, even at Marist in Georgia, even at Kennedy in Warren, Ohio. They're going to have a cross section because that's what Catholic schools are. Agree?
Agreed.
So Brett today says, I just didn't get Trump voters. It's the second admission against interest. The first was by Peggy Noonan. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, but I think it's a very important admission by Brett about what America media elite have gotten wrong about Trump voters. Have you read it yet?
Yeah, Brett? I read it. I did.
What did you think about it?
Well, I think he's right. I think there was a lot of folks who missed all of that. And as it was happening in 2016, there was just a discounting of a whole kind of section of the population. And so no one really got it. And no one really got the polls right. They were way off. And I'm not sure that right now. I think that there is still built in this missing section of the population that either doesn't answer the phone, doesn't tell pollsters exactly what they feel, and really is untapped as far as knowing exactly where they stand.
You and I have talked about this before, and I hate to bring up, I work for the Washington Post. I hate to bring this up, but the worst poll in 2020 was the ABC Washington Post poll less than a week before the election in Wisconsin that said President Biden was ahead by 17 points over President Trump. He won by 0.6 points, a little over 20,000 votes. And I believe that was a significant and distorting event. It certainly weighed on my understanding of what was going to happen. I'm sure it weighed on voters. More importantly, though, if you'd never, ever mix it up with, play golf with, caddy for, go to school with, kids from the great American middle class, you're not going to understand their margin. And by margin, I mean, do they have any resiliency? And I'm about to interview after the break, after the show today, Brett, a pre-interview with Nina Totenberg about her wonderful book, Dinners with Ruth. I mean, it's absolutely charming. It doesn't come out till September, so I won't be releasing the interview until then. But, you know, I read the books of people that I interview.
Yeah, you do.
And she's a Beltway person. And Ruth Ginsburg was a New York, Washington, D.C. person. And they're different from folks. And the reason I referenced 11 trips to Afghanistan, 13 to Iraq, you spent a lot of time with sweaty soldiers in dangerous places, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they tell you how they feel. And listen, I'll tell you another story. I'm covering the convention in Philadelphia for 2016, Hillary Clinton getting the nomination. Fox is not on the inside of the auditorium, shockingly. We are outside, set up on a tent, but we have these studios, and the tent is set up by all of these union guys. And the union guys are wearing purple T-shirts with "I'm with her" on the back. And I walk out of the tent after a show, and this guy comes up to me and says, hey, Brett, hey, listen, come here. And I go over and say, hey, listen, I watch the show all the time, but I just want you to know I'm not with her. I said, oh, what's that? And he points to his back. He says, I'm not with her, okay? And I said, okay. And I said, are there a lot of you like that? And he's like, come on. And he walked with him, and we walk about, I don't know, 200 yards to the lunch area. There's about 150 guys, all of them with purple T-shirts. I'm with her on the back. And he stands on a table, and he goes, hey, guys, how are you guys with her? No hands. How are you guys with Trump? 150 hands. And I said, that's amazing. You know, can I tell that story? Can you come on camera? He said, no, I can't do that.
I like my job. Yeah, Brett,
job. But that's exactly the answer that I think you're talking about here. And I think it's still a phenomenon.
It's a big deal. Last week, I was in Ohio visiting my brother. And the guy across the street who's got a Trump flag. And the guy next door to my brother is not a Trump voter, but the guy across the street, hears I'm in town, comes out with ultra MAGA red T-shirt, says, hey, I hear you're here. And I said, you know, you don't have to wear these. I want you to see I'm ultra MAGA. And my brother had already told me it was ultra MAGA. And I got my ear bent by this guy. Now, this is Trumbull County, which is deep blue until Trump comes along. I mean, it voted for every Democrat except they voted for Nixon in 72 in the landslide, but they're a Democrat county full of steel workers and automobile union, UAW, USW, United Electricians. And they haven't changed their mind, Brett, but media's elites it's more about Manhattan and Washington than it is about anything else. And if you haven't got any lines in, and I just wonder if Brett understands that he hadn't got any lines in. I just don't know. Of all the people that you have on the panel, and you have the best panel in America, you bring in about 25 different people show up on the panel over the course of a month. I think a lot of them have connections to this great middle class. And I think that's what distinguishes it. Is American media pushing off and saying, we'll see you later. We're going to stick with our own? Because it seems to me, except for Fox and your show, they're basically waving goodbye to middle America.
Yeah, I agree with you. Listen, before 2016, I traveled around swing states. I took 36 Ubers in my travels. And at the end of the ride, I'd say, hey, listen, if you feel comfortable, can you tell me how you're going to vote? And 34 out of 36 said they were voting for Trump. And I said, why is that? And they said, well, you know, both sides suck. And he's going to kick the table over and do something different. And those people just were not in the polls. And when election night came and I had the call and I said, that means that Donald J. Trump will be the 45th president of the United States. I remembered those 36 Uber drivers. And I thought, man, we've got to be better at identifying who they are.
They showed up. They showed up and they're going to show up again. I tell people right now, I'm a bad predictor. In fact, on your show on Tuesday night, I was wrong about Maryland. I didn't pay any attention. I thought Kelly Schultz was going to win and Dan Cox won. And I was wrong that the CHIPS bill would be $75 billion. It turned out to be $250 billion. I talked to Cotton about it last hour, and now it's a bill I wouldn't support. But I'm not wrong about the folks in Warren, Ohio. I talked to them. And they're still for Trump, Brett Baer. And they still don't have anyone talking about them and their concerns. More importantly, why? Without scorn and contempt. And I don't know if that's going to change in media except on Fox between now and Election Day.
I agree with you. I will say the caveat is that there is a little air that has come out of the balloon, even in that population. And maybe not much, but some. And the January 6th committee, as much as people discount it, does have some impact around the edges, I think, with independents. Maybe not this what we're talking about exactly, but it seems like there is a hunger for another alternative, at least a little bit.
Oh, I agree with that. If that alternative will turn over the table.
Right. Exactly. They're kicking off the table.
if they're turn over the table, I'm gonna steal for that from you, Brett Baer, because that is exactly the motivation. Turn over the table. It's not working for me. Brett Baer, we'll be watching you on Special Report tonight. Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk to you and have you on, Brett. I appreciate your time.
You bet. See you.
I tell you, America, there are very few places I don't watch media anymore except for Brett's show. I just don't. Hey, I go to bed too early for most of this stuff because I got to get up way early to figure it out. I can read a lot faster than people talk, but I also just don't trust anybody to understand what's really going on in America. What really, Peggy Noonan wrote a column that Brett Stevens today, I'm going to read the Brett Stevens article again. I got time this hour. I'm going to read it again. Peggy Noonan wrote a column in 2016 called The Rise of the Unprotected. And unless you go among them, and I mean, travel with your fellow Americans in the way that Selena Zito does and Brett does when he's out on the road and I do when I'm out on the road, unless you do that, you're not going to get it. You're just not. If you haven't driven 12 hours on a freeway anywhere and stopped in a few rest areas and listened or gone to the local diner and just listen, talk to some cops and some people and some teachers and the San Diego bureaucrats who are putting masks on kids, they have not been listening. You're just going to be clueless. Brett Stevens finally figured it out. I'll read it to you when I come back. Stay tuned. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The new Iowa poll from the Des Moines Register shows that only 27% of Iowans approve of the job Joe Biden is doing. That's incredibly low. That's getting down to the territory that Richard Nixon was at in August of 1974. A collapse in support. I want to finish the Brett Stevens column I read to you in the last segment and then take some calls about it at 1-800-520-1234. Brett's writing about Trump supporters. Nor were they impressed by Trump critics who had their own penchant for hypocrisy and outright slander. To this day, Stevens continues, precious few anti-Trumpers have been honest with themselves about the elaborate hoax. There's just no other word for it. There was the Steele dossier and all the bogus allegations credulously parroted in the mainstream media that flowed from it. Brett might have added the Mueller investigation. A final question for myself. Would I be wrong to lambast Trump's current supporters, the ones who want him back in the White House despite his refusal to accept his electoral defeat in the historic outrage of January 6th? Morally speaking, no. It's one thing to take a gamble on a candidate who promises to break with business as usual. It's another to do that with an ex-president with a record of trying to break the Republic itself. But I would also approach those voters in a much different spirit than I did the last time. Quote, a drop of honey catches more flies than a gallon of gall, noted Abraham Lincoln early in his political career. If you would win a man to your cause, first convince him that you are his sincere friend. Words to live by, particularly for those of us in the business of persuasion. What do you think? Let's start with Guy in Baltimore. Good morning, Guy. What do you make of Brett Stevens' column?
He's at the very tail end, you can tell that he is not learning very much. And an example of that is I listen to Bloomberg News during the day because I can tell when they're lying. And they had an honest, legitimate, long discussion about Liz Cheney being a reasonable and acceptable alternative to Trump. For Trump voters, five people commented on it, and they all agreed Liz Cheney would be acceptable.
Did they bring up she couldn't win 5% in that race?
No. They thought that people are tired of Trump. Obviously, they want to turn to the opposite of Trump, and that Liz Cheney would be a reasonable mainstream Trump supporter alternative to Trump. That's how out of touch Bloomberg is.
Well, that's a great example, Guy. Liz is a friend of mine, but I'm an objective reporter. She couldn't get 5% in a Republican presidential primary.
She couldn't get 1%. But maybe not.
There are Republicans who greatly admire her and think that Nancy Pelosi 1-6 committee is a good thing, but they're below 5%. At that level, I don't go lower than 5% because I don't know.
And that's fine. But to have five people and not one of them laugh at that suggestion.
Yeah, that is cluelessness on an epic scale. You're right. That's the Manhattan Beltway effect. You're absolutely right. Thank you, Guy. Jim in Atlanta. What do you think, Jim?
Hello, Jim.
I couldn't agree more with his column, and I'm glad he wrote it because I used to like Brett. I stopped liking him, and now I'll continue to read him. I hope he really believes what he's saying.
Oh, I think he does. And it must have been bitter for the New York Times editorial team who melted down over a Tom Cotton op-ed to read that one. Bitter, bitter, bitter. Jim, thank you. Dave in Ohio, 1-800-520-1234. What do you think, Dave?
I think it was very, very well thought out, and it must have been, as you say, difficult for him to write that, because the issue of that, friends of mine who are Republicans who did not like Trump, it was all about his personality. It was all about his approach to other people, his trying to bully people, and he's always right. You know, he's never made a mistake, and that's why people did not vote for him.
I've always said they had an aesthetic critique of Trump. Critique. They thought he was vulgar.
Right. Well, and sometimes he is. I mean, let's face it. But the difficulty, I think he's going to announce that probably after the midterms. And now that the Republican Party is faced with a really serious issue because have some excellent, excellent candidates.
Well, look, I think he is the favorite if he announces. Not a prohibitive favorite, but a favorite. I think he'll probably be the nominee if he runs, but I could be wrong. I was wrong. You know, I'm often wrong. Nobody knows anything in America. You know, people don't, there just isn't any data. Who can extrapolate over one state, much less 50? Who can see events unfolding around you? Who can understand the impact of aging on anyone, the impact of this utterly failed Biden presidency? It's beyond me. All I can do is objectively tell you what I think is the fact, which is if he's running, he's the front runner. Thank you, Dave. Fred in Chicago, what do you make of the Brett Stevens piece?
Good morning, Hugh. Well, I have two issues with the column. One is one thing the column did say, and the other is one thing the column didn't say. The column asserted that Trump had tried to break the republic, and I don't see it that way one bit. There were contests of prior elections. Had Trump advocated violence or something like that, I would have understood that. But in my view, what would break the republic is if the court-packing efforts that are afoot right
yes,
now.
Yes, that would break the republic. That's the end of the rule
it.
Of law. That's
yeah,
the end
that
of the
would
rule
do
law.
It. So that's the issue that I have with what he said. As for what he didn't say, I didn't hear two words in that column that were crucial for me: Supreme Court.
Yep.
And that is what your podcast with him, last month or a couple months ago, was entirely about.
Yep.
It was about the Supreme Court.
And it's dispositive on my vote for Trump.
Yeah.
It will always be the right vote.
You know, and I
always
remember in 2016. Ted Cruz made an, at the time, eminently reasonable statement. He said, you know, this was during the primaries. He said, folks, Trump might cut a deal with Chuck Schumer and nominate some, you know, milquetoast candidate in exchange for whatever, because Trump is a deal maker. And I listened to that. I said, wow, Ted Cruz, you know, that makes sense. That very well might happen. But I said, you know, the odds, I just was saying this to myself, the odds were 100% that Hillary Clinton would nominate a hardcore leftist to the court. So given the choice between A and B, I chose A, Trump, because I knew there was at least a chance of success, and I got more than I ever possibly could have wanted with that vote, and I don't regret it for one trillisecond.
You know, and I'll tell a story. Thank you, Fred, a story. I was leaving a panel during my NBC years with Pete Wehner. I've known Pete a long time. And Pete's a never-Trumper. And it was after the Gorsuch nomination. And we were walking out in front of the building in which all the networks have their D.C. bureaus. And I said something on the lines of, Pete, if there's a second, this is before Kavanaugh, after Gorsuch, and certainly before Amy Coney Barrett, said if there's a second Trump nominee like Gorsuch and he or she is confirmed, then it is a dispositive argument for having voted for Trump. And he would not agree to that. I didn't even bring up a third because I didn't think it was going to happen. And he wouldn't agree to that. And in fact, it is dispositive. It is simply dispositive. If you are a constitutionalist, If the Constitution, if the rule of law matters more than anything else, that is dispositive. And folks know that and are trying to get away from it by saying he attempted to break the Republic. That does not, he did not succeed, nor did he intend, nor did it happen. And the three Supreme Court justices are dispositive on Clinton versus Trump. Let me go to Lenny in Cleveland. Lenny, you had a short bit yesterday. I'm going to give you a little bit more time today. Go ahead, Lenny.
All righty. This looks like Brett trying to redeem himself with a certain amount of readership. It looks like he's trying to make amends. However, the one thing he didn't do is recognize whether or not Trump's term was good or bad. The comment about breaking the Republic, I thought, was particularly troublesome because I think he still, you know, 2016 was a choice between two candidates, as all elections are. And Trump was the better choice, and he couldn't realize that. And if we come up in 2020 and Trump is the candidate and whoever the horrible Democrats will put up, Trump will still be the better choice, even with all of his faults. And he's saying, you know, I want to sweet talk Trump voters.
No, very, very perceptive, Lenny. He did not say that. And until someone comes up with, it still would have been better to vote for Hillary Clinton. Even after everything we know, that's the argument I want to read because it won't persuade me. Thank you. Let me go to Detroit and Glenn. Hi, Glenn in Detroit. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
So he missed a whole section of people like, so if he, the way he described his life and where he lives and how he lives is exactly, he could have been talking about me and my friends. And we all sat around before that 2016 election, said the same thing. Let's kick the table over. We're sick of both of the parties. We want somebody to go in and blow it up. And he was, I agree with everything he said about the Trump, the typical Trump supporter that he was talking about, the blue collar guy.
You're talking about what Brett Baer said, not what Brett Stevens wrote.
Brett Stevens, both. I'm talking about both. So Brett Stevens was right about all the middle class voters that are forgotten and left on, you know, left aside. Now here's where I take real issue with this guy. He's talking about the moral position of Trump and how he's coming on his high horse and how his morals and comparing to Trump's morals. And I know he's a Democrat. He's a Democratic supporter. Let's just look at the Democrats. So who are the biggest racists? He's calling Trump a racist. The biggest racists are the Democrats. All they see is race through everything they do. It's all about race.
Now, Glenn, I gotta cut you off, but I do want to correct the record. Brett is actually a Republican, longstanding, and a conservative, longstanding. But you're right about race mattering a great deal more to Democrats than it does to Republicans. Thank you, friend. I have to do a little business. I have to first remind everyone, I'm going down to ALEC next week, the American Legislative Exchange Council. So tune in on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. I'm going to be in Hotlanta, in Atlanta. And Dwayne and I are going to the varsity with Glenn. I'm not sure when. I'm getting invitations to do all sorts of things. I can't do them because ALEC has got me on a wheel. I mean, I'm like a mule turning the wheel, but I am going to get to the varsity. And I want to tell you about andrewandtodd.com as well, because house prices went up last month in America to an average of $412,000. There is no decline in housing prices coming. This is not 2008. You're not going to be able to buy at the bottom. If you're going to buy a house, you have to buy it now from andrewandtodd.com. There was Sierra Pacific Mortgage. You can call them at 888-888-1172. Rates have gone up. Would have been better to buy a house 6 months ago. Much better to buy it a year ago. But you didn't, so you can either wring your hands or act. If you're going to act, call them up. They'll get it done. They'll lock it in, 888-888-1172. And especially if you need a reverse mortgage for your mom or your dad or yourself, andrewandtodd.com. Few more of your calls coming up, 1-800-520-1234 for Brett Stevens' column. Stay with me. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Let me tell you that rockthewoke.com remains a place you must visit. RockTheWoke.com is a project of Job Creators Network, a sponsor of our show. RockTheWoke.com is where you go to organize against crazy mandates like that being imposed by San Diego Unified School District on its students. RockTheWoke.com is where you get ESG out of the corporate world and them back to worrying about you as shareholders. RockTheWoke.com is simply necessary. And my friends at Job Creators Network work on it every day. They're in the halls of Congress every day. They deserve your support. Please go to RockTheWoke.com. And when they get the big bus out and they go about the United States, they'll publish the schedule there. And that's when you can go and meet Alfredo Ortiz and the gang from Job Creators Network, RockTheWoke.com. Back to Brett Stevens. I want to get a few calls in. Joe in Oceanside, California. Hi, Joe, out to the West Coast. It's early, Joe. Good morning.
Colonel Joe in Oceanside. Hey, Hugh, that was a great article, but I believe he dropped the ball at the end and his eyes are still kind of closed. You cannot sweet talk Trump voters with honey. They will not be fooled again, as the WHO has said. They have had enough with the establishment, and they are not happy. But you can't change their mind.
No, you can't. You're right about that, Joe. Thank you. Another Joe, this one in Pennsylvania. Hello, Joe in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, hello, Hugh. I want to draw a comparison between Trump and a commander I had in Vietnam. He came in and took over the unit. I sat in a staff meeting. I was a captain at the time. And a chaplain sat next to me. And every other word out of the commander, the new commander's mouth, was an obscenity, explicit. Anyway, when he was done with the meeting, after about 2 hours, I walked out with the chaplain and I said, I'm a Catholic, you're a Catholic. I can't understand how you sat in that meeting. He said, look, Joe, this is my third tour in Vietnam with this man. He gets things done. I will follow him to Hades and back.
Oh,
that's
wow.
All I could say.
All right. There you go. Thank you, Joe. Let me go to Kentucky. James. Good morning, James. 1-800-520-1234. What say you, James?
Hey, it was the article was very well written. It was articulate and very accurate, quite frankly. But there was one part at the very end. Could you read that last sentence that he said with the word persuasive in it?
You have it handy? Oh, okay. I got it right here. It is with the word persuasive in it. I would also approach Trump voters in a much different spirit than I did last time. A drop of honey catches more flies than a gallon of gall, noted Abraham Lincoln early in his political career. If you would win a man to your cause, first convince him that you are his friend. Words to live by, particularly for those of us in the business of persuasion.
The business of persuasion? My God, he's a reporter, is he not?
No, he's a columnist. He's
okay,
a columnist.
Well, I'll give him a little bit of a break there, but we people in middle America are smart enough to understand when someone is trying to snow us and versus when they're reporting the news. We're not going to be bought off with this sweet honey and this sweet talk. When you said about the other fellow, the friend of yours, that it was dispositive whenever after even just two Supreme Court justices.
Yeah.
I'm also an originalist and a graduate of law. And that's as soon as he said he was going to go pick off the Federalist list, I said, oh, my God, he's going to flip the court. Oh, my God, this guy's got to get in. That was absolutely the number one reason for Trump to get in there. Oh, and by the way, he just did our country a great favor by all the policies that he adopted. I mean, how much better could President be?
I wish that Brett would do a follow up. Here's what Trump got right before he says, don't vote for him again.
Beautiful.
That would be a genuine part two mea culpa. Thank you. I want to get to Tom in Atlanta. Hi, Tom. Coming down your way with Alec next week. How are you?
Hey. So I kind of tagged on along with the last guy. The guy's still arrogant. The guy still thinks he's right. And he doesn't get it. And he doesn't get the true-blooded Americans. And I'll count myself among those. I've got a postgraduate degree. I'm a medical professional. But you know what? These people have to be shown, from Zuckerberg to the media to all of them, that they are not going to get away with this and will fight to get Trump back in there, because not only of his policies, but these people need to learn a lesson and they need to respect the American voter.
What do you think they're trying to do to Herschel in Manhattan Beltway media circles right now?
They're trying to do what they do to all staunch Christian conservatives or God-fearing Americans. Destroy him.
They are trying to destroy Herschel. They are. And it's not going to work, by the way. It's going to bounce off of him.
No. Thank you.
Hey, Tom, thank you. That's it for today, America. I've got a lot of work to do. I've got to do interviews today with Nina Totenberg and Henry Kissinger. They both have new books coming out, and it's pre-publication. But I've had to read them, and I have, and they're both wonderful reads, as one would expect. And the accomplished professionals that they are. And you'll hear them later, but I'm working long today. So is Dwayne and Adam and Jacob, and I appreciate that they are doing so. Don't go anywhere, America. Stay on this station and come back.
I've gotten myself in trouble. And hell, I might be president now if it weren't for the fact I said I had an uncle who was a coal miner. Turned out I didn't have anybody in the coal mines, you know what I mean?
Really?
I tried that crap, you know, about, you know.
Welcome back, America. That was then Senator Joe Biden 17 years ago on the Jon Stewart show admitting he had no coal mine. And yesterday he was in Massachusetts talking about his great-grandfather who was a coal mining engineer. Senator Tom Cotton, you worked with Senator Biden and when he was president of the Senate. And, you know, at this point, I'm completely befuddled by why they cannot keep him on a small script, closely written, that makes sense. I really don't know why they put him out there anymore.
Yeah, Hugh, as you know, I've been saying for several months, at least since he went to Warsaw and blurted out that it was the American policy to foment regime change in Russia, that it would be better for everyone, including Joe Biden, if he would just stick to written scripts that were prepared in advance and not speak extemporaneously. They obviously have not taken my advice, and I'm not sure they'll ever get the voluble Joe Biden to do so. But as you saw yesterday, it's just not very good for Joe Biden. It's not very good for our country.
No, and I didn't think he could go below 30% in the polling, but I think President Biden is going to prove me wrong about that. Senator Cotton, I want to talk to you specifically about the CHIPS Act. On Wednesday night, I was on Special Report with Brett Baer, and Ari Fleischer said he didn't like the CHIPS Act. And I said, no, Ari, I got to disagree with you. It's $54 billion in subsidies for semiconductor production and $25 billion in tax credits for semiconductor production and fabrication plants in the United States. We need this. We need clean water, clean air, good food, and semiconductor chips. And I'm all for this. And I wake up the next morning and $74 billion in spending and credits had become $250 billion. What the hell happened overnight?
Well, Hugh, those bills have a way of growing rapidly in Washington, especially when the Democrats are in charge. So... The core of the bill that Senator Schumer presented over the weekend was what you described. It was a combination of direct grants and tax credits for semiconductor fabrication plants to be built in America, along with what's called an open radio access network, which is a kind of alternative to Chinese-designed telecommunications equipment. But then a coalition of senators from both parties convinced Senator Schumer to add a much broader bill on it. I mean, it didn't just balloon in money, it ballooned in pages. A lot of that is designed to create new funds for the National Science Foundation, the Department of Commerce, and others, in some cases to address genuine needs. I have reluctantly opposed this so far because these are genuine needs, and especially on semiconductor chips, genuine concerns. I have real concerns, though, about the security and the counterintelligence protections in these measures. For instance, the National Science Foundation is not the CIA. It's not the National Security Agency. They're primarily there to fund academic research at America's universities. You know, nothing wrong with that. Let's just say that they don't have the tightest controls on the technology they develop. And I have concerns that we'll be funneling money out the door in Washington to go into basic research across the country, and then the Chinese will be running away with that technology out the back door.
Now, Senator, this morning, your friend and mine, Rob Portman, is on Twitter. Last night, I took to the Senate floor to correct the record on how my Safeguarding American Innovation Act was stripped from the CHIPS package currently under consideration. And he goes on to detail the concern that you have. Who in the world doesn't want the protections against Chinese exploitation and intellectual property theft and espionage in this bill. How could that possibly not be in this bill?
The answer to your question is simple. Liberal Democrats. Remember, liberal Democrats like Joe Biden and Merrick Garland shut down the Department of Justice's China initiative, which was designed in part to stop Chinese espionage at America's universities. It's a real and genuine problem. We've had a professor at University of Arkansas who's been convicted of working for Chinese-owned or sponsored entities in advanced engineering fields. The chairman of Harvard's Department of Chemistry, for goodness sake, faced charges of espionage. It happens all across the country. But liberal Democrats, like Joe Biden and Merrick Garland, shut down the China initiative. And anytime you point out that the coronavirus came from Wuhan or that it should be called the Wuhan coronavirus in the same way that we call have names like Lyme disease or West Nile or what have you, they call you a racist and xenophobic, probably responsible for hate crimes against Asian Americans. It's just another example of how they've gone so far around the bend on identity politics that they don't even address real and genuine security problems.
You know, before I moved back to D.C. in 2015, I had lunch with an assistant United States attorney in Orange County who detailed for me the number of prosecutions against Chinese agents in the United States, some of them Chinese nationals, some of them Chinese Americans who had been deep cover for a long time. It was a large number a decade ago. It's an extraordinary number now. They play to win. The CCP plays to win. So I can't believe this. So my question is, what happens next? It went from being a bill I was full-throated behind to one I don't think we can afford to pass this as is. Can it get back to what it was, Senator Cotton?
Hugh, I don't know, in part because Chuck Schumer couldn't run a one-car funeral, much less run the United States Senate. You know, we voted on Tuesday afternoon to proceed to a bill that didn't yet exist. That's why you go on TV Tuesday afternoon talking about what you think is one bill, and you wake up the next morning and it's 1,000 pages longer and three times the cost. So it's unclear to me what will be in the bill that we vote on next week and how what's in the bill will affect the coalition of votes. Now, again, I want to stress that it's a real and genuine problem that the Senate is trying to resolve. I'm just not sure that this is the correct way to resolve it. And I'm not sure that it hones in on the most important problem. There are all kinds of semiconductors made around the world, and plenty of them made here in America, and a lot of them are not fancy or sophisticated or cutting edge. But the most cutting edge, the most sophisticated, are made in one place, Taiwan, an island against which China has irredentist claims and thousands of missiles aimed at. It is an urgent and vital national security priority for us to work with the government of Taiwan and the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company to build resilience into their production lines. I'm not saying they should move them out of Taiwan. We wouldn't expect them to do that. But they need more fabrication facilities that are outside of Chinese missile range. Because if China were to ever invade Taiwan, then it would have the potential to give China a stranglehold over the modern economy. And I'm not exaggerating, a true stranglehold over the modern economy, something that we cannot allow to happen.
Yeah, Senator, as my kids were growing up, I repeated one phrase again and again and again, focus and execute. And they laugh about it now because it was my mantra, focus and execute. It's how you learn to move from point A to point B, focus and execute. Can the United States Senate focus on what you just articulated and articulate a legislative strategy to meet that problem, which is urgent? And it is of great value to the West and to the United States and to the places where they are built. It is not pork. It is urgent. Can they focus and execute?
We will see, Hugh. If this bill doesn't pass, I have some other ideas. I will focus on this very specific challenge for the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company. If it does pass, I will continue to monitor how it's implemented and whether we are building more of those most cutting edge fabrication facilities in the United States and in friendly nations. And if that doesn't, then let's just say I have a few more ideas up my sleeve that the Senate might be able to take up in the future or that a future Republican administration would be able to pursue.
Now, Senator, I want to switch to the president's inability to pay attention to what the Supreme Court says. 3 weeks ago in West Virginia versus EPA, I'm going to make this comprehensible to Steelers fans. The Supreme Court said executive branch from the president to the GS2 in the lowest ranking agency anywhere. You may not act unless Congress has given you the authority to do so on any major question. You have to have an explicit authorization. Yesterday, the president had short-term amnesia and forgot that the Supreme Court rebuked his EPA 3 weeks ago for trying to go where there was no legislative direction to go. What do you do about this? This is simply a complete abdication by the president of any responsibility the oath he took to uphold the Constitution of the United States.
Well, there's a few things we can do about it, Hugh. First, we went in November and we used our power in Congress to stop this money. We were very effective in the final 2 years of the Obama administration in using the spending power to put curbs on their regulatory agenda. We can do so again if we win in November. Second, I suspect that if the president goes forward with some of the actions he's announced, exceeding his authority under law, those agencies trying to grab power that Congress never intended them to have, that those people who are injured by it will have a strong lawsuit, and you'll find judges who are willing to stop it in its tracks. It'll still do damage in the meantime, just like those EPA actions had done damage, or like the SEC's efforts to strangle the fossil fuel industry's access to capital markets in America is driving up the price of gas and electricity. But the Supreme Court has been very clear on this. The vast administrative state in Washington cannot look in musty, dusty corners of laws that are decades old and find vague clauses that all of a sudden give them the power to regulate huge swaths of our economy.
Well said. Last question, Senator. Yesterday, the San Diego Union School District, Unified School District, announced that, or this week, that masks must be worn in summer school or you have to go home, and they're back in. I don't believe there's any science supporting this whatsoever, any dispositive science. You're on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Just tell me if I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, I will retract. But I think every school board member who supported masking and closing schools should be defeated in November. And I'm especially hoping it happens in San Diego. What do you think about masking school children right now, Senator Cotton?
No, Hugh, I'm aware of no evidence whatsoever that suggests school children need to wear masks. In fact, the evidence is contrary, that it harms kids' development. It harms their ability to learn to read and to write, to speak clearly, especially the younger ones. To listen and to pay attention. And the vast, vast trove of evidence suggests that kids are uniquely not vulnerable to this coronavirus.
So why are they doing it? Well, I mean, you have to guess. You don't have any evidence, but why are they doing this?
I think for a lot of liberals in big cities, oftentimes secular, it's become a kind of secular religion to worship at the foot of the science, capital T, capital S, and so-called experts like Tony Fauci, a little Wilsonian scold.
He is a Wilsonian scold. Boy, that's perfect. I think you meant capital S, capital C. Worship at the altar of science. But you're from Arkansas, so we're going to give you a break on that. Senator Cotton, thank you, my friend. Come back next week. As always, succinct. Capital S, capital C. Right? Succinct. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned. Jim Talent is next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Jim Talent's one of our favorite guests. Senator Jim Talent represented Missouri for years in the United States Senate and before that in the United States House. Normally, I talk to him about national security. I have a political question for you this morning, Senator. How are you? Good Thursday.
Well, I'm fine, and I love you too, you.
Okay. Well, here's the headline at CNN last night. Risks abound for both parties in uncertain Senate races. And it talks about on the Republican side, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin. On the Democratic side, of course, New Hampshire and Georgia, Nevada, Colorado. But then it has this quote, some of these candidates need to get their blank together, said a Republican working on Senate races. They are potentially putting at risk very winnable seats. And then they go on to talk about, you know, Herschel Walker's had some gaffes, et cetera. I want to ask you, in all the coverage of your Senate campaigns, both that which you won and that which you lost, did anyone in the media ever know what was actually going on inside your campaign or have access to your numbers or really have a story that was dead center correct?
No. Or, you know, it's as scarce as hen's teeth, as my mama used to say, because unless you are living, it's a really good question, you. I love to talk about the ins and outs of politics. It's my belief that unless you are living with a campaign, unless, first of all, you know something about politics to begin with and you have good political instincts, and some people in the media do. I mean, you know, a lot of your guests do, Drucker and others, right?
Right.
And then you have to live with the campaign over time in order to get a sense of how it's evolving, what it's really doing. And so I just think it's really the insiders who are sound politically to begin with know. So those are the people that you need to be talking to. And a lot of it is feel. You can see some of it in numbers, but a lot of it is just, you know, I really think we're doing real good here, you know, and it's the feel I'm getting. But the answer is basically no.
You know, when they talk about Herschel, I've only done one event with Herschel. And I know it's dangerous to get between Herschel Walker and a Georgia fan. That's what I know. Stay out of the way. And they don't care if he fumbles an answer. They don't care. They know he'll vote the right way. He'll be a Republican. He'll caucus with the Republicans. And he's not Raphael Warnock. And they don't really care that he didn't disclose up front that he had four children, not two. They don't care. I think that the team Herschel put that out early just to get it done rather than get hit in the last week of the campaign. But I just don't think anybody has any idea. In Pennsylvania, by contrast, I don't think they have any idea whether or not Dr. Oz is going to be able to get traction, or any idea whether or not John Fetterman's illness, and may God bless him with a recovery, but it ain't quick. It's not happening. I'm just sick of Beltway people opining on races. It's like I was on with Brett. I was totally wrong about Maryland. I said, look, I don't know anything about this, but I think Kelly Schultz will win. And she didn't. Dan Cox won, because I just didn't think Democrat money into Republican campaigns ever a good sign for a campaign. I was wrong, but then again, I'm not worried about being wrong because I didn't study it. I just, whenever I see a quote from an unnamed Republican strategist, it could be somebody who's been out of work for 10 years in D.C.
Yeah, I really would discount that. And I, you know, I just, again, I think you need to talk to, or you need to be close, and you need to do it over time because you need to see what's changing, what's evolving. Now, you mentioned Walker. I mean, the number one thing for voters, and this is because voters are rational, is what are these people going to do for me if they're elected?
Yes.
And I don't mean that in a narrow sense. What are they going to do for my country, my community, my family, et cetera? Is it going to make things better for me? Okay. And the things I care about, and issues like, you know, statements you make about your background, et cetera, are relevant to the question of authenticity and credibility. So you have to have a good message and you have to be authentic in carrying it, but they're not, that sort of a thing is by no means, you know, fatal. It's, in fact, I think coming out with it and saying it the way he did, comes across as being pretty upfront. So
now, you know, what's fatal is having an affair and having it come out in the last 2 weeks. That was the North Carolina race. Tom Tillis is in the Senate today because his opponent, was a dirtbag, and it came out in the last 2 weeks of the race. And that will kill a campaign. I mean, that's different.
Again, it undermines the authenticity, which is important because they need to believe not only that you can help them, your ideas and your abilities can help them, but that what you've been telling them is true. I had my first campaign consultant who was not a political guy. He was a PR guy. And he said, what you tell people is not the same thing as what you persuade them of. Okay?
Yeah.
He said, you have to be credible. It's just, in that sense, it's like selling a product. I mean, Ronald Reagan used to talk about that. You know, I'm the soap, sell me. But, he, you know, people believed that Ronald Reagan would do what he said he would do.
And Jim Talent, 30 seconds. I don't think anybody believes anything Joe Biden says anymore after yesterday. It's just, he's too old to persuade. He can't persuade anyone of anything.
And
am I overstating it?
With that? What was up about picking that place?
It looked like
an apocalyptic setting.
It did look like Mad Max. And why they went there.
Exactly. I'm expecting to see Mel Gibson on a motorcycle.
It was Bob Dole in the field. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was what it was. It was a metaphor for his presidency. Jim Talent, always a pleasure. Follow him at Jim Talent. Follow me to hour number 3. Brett Baer is next. We're going to talk about
about that very speech with Brett Baer when we come back, America. Stay tuned.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.